Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Mark Chaplow, and I am here today representing the appellant, Michael Corey Boring. May it please the court. Your Honors, 12 years ago, I stood before a division of this court and argued one of the cases cited in today's case, In Re, the Marriage of Antuna. I raise that because I want to bring to the court, attention to the court, kind of an anecdotal aspect of that case. A few months after the court's ruling in Re, the Marriage of Antuna, I attended a CLE. And in that CLE, my respected opposing counsel in that case, Michael DeManna, was asked to stand up and to discuss In Re, the Marriage of Antuna. In his introduction, he said, he asked the fellow members of the family law bar to listen to the facts of this case. He said, in this case, there's one party that is a doctor that makes $19,500 a month. The other party works on computers and makes approximately $3,300 a month. The parties were married for 17 years. The end result of the case was that the lesser income party received maintenance of $2,000 a month for 2 years. There's a large groan from the attendees, at which point Mr. DeManna pointed out, would it make a difference to you if I pointed out that the lesser income party in this case was the husband? At which point there was a very loud acknowledgement and laughter from the group that this was something that they were all aware of. I bring that up because here we are again, some 12 years later, in a similar case. Now, if the court may recall, In Re, the Marriage of Antuna also involved a very large property distribution issue in which the court determined that the mother in that case had a $165,000 valued business. Father had not received any portion of that, and the court sent it back down primarily on that issue and also mentioned that maintenance would then be also need to be reconsidered as well in that case. So what do you have here? Your Honor, counsel would have you say, the court said, I reviewed the factors. Therefore, it flies. We have a 20-year marriage. We have a husband who at the time of the dissolution was unemployed. In fact, the district court in this case, Judge Berryhill, found that he was not involuntarily underemployed or unemployed. He found that he was trying to get a job and he couldn't get a job. Nevertheless, despite saying specifically in his order, I have to take the parties as I find them on the date of a dissolution, he went ahead and imputed $2,600 of income to Mr. Boring. Nevertheless, the facts of this case were such, and I think, Your Honor, they've been admitted in this case, that mother's income was not $13,923, not including her bonuses. And Judge Berryhill said, well, she got a bonus last year. We don't know if she'll get one this year. So I'm not going to count those either. So $14,000 a month, no income to husband at the time of the divorce. The end result was maintenance of $1,000 a month for 2 years, a 20-year marriage. Father, husband, did not have a college degree, had worked in the past as a project manager. There was ample evidence placed before the court at the time of the hearing about the fact that given the recession that was omnipresent at the time, and that the court quite frankly as well noted in his order, that Mr. Boring had essentially no chance of obtaining a job as a project manager as he had had in the past, because at that point in time you had to at least have a college degree.
$2,600 imputed by the court based on his prior employment as a project manager or his most recent prior employment, which was something completely different.
It was something completely different, Your Honor, and it was a short-term job where he had received $15 an hour, if I recall correctly, Your Honor. Now, having said that, Your Honor, I would ask the court to go to the specific factors, because 14 asks us to look at the financial resources of the party. Well, anyway, the marriage of Yates stands for the proposition that you cannot impute income without first finding voluntary underemployment. So regardless of where he found the $15 an hour, Your Honor, he specifically found the opposite. He's not involuntarily underemployed or unemployed. He's trying to get a job. You know, the exhibits presented to the court, hundreds of pages of job applications that were put in by Mr. Boring during the course of the divorce process. So he can't say that Mr. Boring is voluntarily underemployed, yet he imputed anyway. Time necessary to acquire sufficient education or training. At the time of the divorce proceeding, Mr. Boring wasn't sure exactly how much. He had some college credits, Your Honor. He had a certificate. Wasn't sure how long it would take him to get a full degree. And the court noted that.
Can I ask you a question about Yates for just a minute?
Yes, Your Honor.
It was the proposition for which you cited Yates, was that for child support or maintenance?
Your Honor, it's my understanding that that the definition under Yates was in determination of a maintenance request.
So the question of whether that he could impute income or not, that was on the issue of maintenance, not child support?
That is my understanding of the case.
Thank you.
So then the question comes up, what is a sufficient time period? I would ask the court to look to inlay the marriage of Olar. In that case, the court, despite the fact that the wife in that case was able to get a job as a key punch operator, the court said, no, she can go back to college and become an opera singer, study music so she could become the teacher, that the job that she wanted to work in. In that case, Your Honor, the court gave, if I remember correctly, in Olar, gave wife 5 years to go get a college degree. Equal lifestyle.
You know, interrupting if I'm Mr. Chaplot.
Yes, Your Honor.
Would it have made any difference to the trial court, do you think, based upon what the trial court said in its oral findings, if your client had presented to the court a plan, here's why I want to go to school, generally this is what I want to study, this is what I think the cost is going to be? Do you think that would have made a difference to the court?
It's hard to tell, Your Honor, because the court gave less, frankly, no more than a sentence in his order saying that he wasn't sure how long it would take him to get an education. He didn't put any further real emphasis on that point in his oral argument. So I really couldn't tell you what was in the mind of Judge Berryhill at the time as to the plan.
Let me just expand on Judge Bernard's question a little bit. How could you expect the trial court to do more than that one sentence if there wasn't any evidence for him to talk about it?
The fact that the court didn't come back to that point, Your Honor, and state that, make a finding that he hasn't shown me that he could do it in a certain period of time, or I'm going to make that determination that he needs 2 years to do that. In fact, Your Honor, what the court said was, I think he needs 2 years to find a job.
What did Mr. Boring present to the court as far as his education and how long it would take him?
Your Honor, I believe as far as the education, Mr. Boring presented to the court his testimony as to what he had done so far. He had gone to community colleges, he had gotten a certificate, and had testified to that to the court at the time.
Future plans for that?
Your Honor, part of the problem, the aspect of the timing of the case was at the time that of permanent orders, Mr. Boring had continued substantial job search, was making applications on a daily basis, weekly basis, constantly looking for opportunities. And the other aspect of this, Your Honor, and I would say it's probably comparable to the case cited, quite frankly, by the appellee in this case, Mitchell, because in that case, as in this case, the person who was the woman who received maintenance in that case had a certificate as a school teacher. At the time of the dissolution, the court gave her maintenance for a period of 5 years and said she needs that period of time to kind of get back on her feet. Her husband appealed and said that she has a certificate, she can go teach. And the court said that it's that absence of 20 years that we have to take into account, that it's going to take some time. In this case, Your Honor, Mr. Boring, it had been a substantial number of years since he had even worked as a project manager, because during this marriage, by agreement of the parties, Mr. Boring had stopped working as a project manager, had begun attempts at a personal business that the parties had attempted to put together. That failed, not surprisingly, given the economics of the time period, but that business had failed, and he'd been out of the business of project management for a number of years prior to the time of the hearing. So there was question as to what he would do, although he was trying his best to get back into the business that he was familiar with. Your Honor, I'm going to try to buzz through a few more cases of relevance here as the time is quickly passing. Standard of living. When we looked at this case and when the court made its ruling, and I want to point out to the court, because the way Judge Berryhill made his final determination of maintenance, he said, well, she's about $1,300 short and he's about $1,300 short. I'm going to equalize it and give him $1,000, or give him $1,000 to make him $1,300 short as well. Your Honor, at the time of the dissolution, the parties were still living in the same residence. My client was not claiming the cost of the mortgage as part of his expenses. He was going to have to get out and pay his own mortgage. He was going to have his own expenses. And I would assess to you, Your Honors, that at this point in time, you're looking at the breadwinner whose typical, and I'll speak from experience as a family law attorney, Your Honor, whose typical financial affidavit is high. It shows all these great expenses that they have to pay, and the other spouse is trying to live on ramen noodles and just deal with the expenses that they can afford. So when the court looks at those financial affidavits, there are things in there that the court actually took out. Attorney's fees, well, hopefully those go away. Things like that. But we really are looking at a situation by his own determination that father will then have to have a standard of living around $4,600 a month, $3,600 a month, and mother will continue to have one around $12,000 a month, $10,000 a month. Did not really, again, it's not even close to equalization, and the court clearly does not have to equalize, as my case in the marriage of Antunes says, but the court does have to look a little bit into the lifestyle these folks have. Clearly, when all is said and done, you don't see that here.
What was the child support order in this case, sir?
$1,000, Your Honor.
And who was paying whom?
Mother was paying that to father due to a share parenting arrangement.
Okay.
Duration of marriage. Well, again, Your Honor, this is a 20-year marriage. We're looking at a very small percentage of time. And Your Honor, this court's in the past, in the marriage of Wagner, has looked at a similar situation. And interestingly enough, her mother was given a maintenance award, which is about 14% of the husband's income for 3 years. The court found that to be abuse and sent it back down as being too little. Father was given 2 years, 7% of mother's income. Your Honor, I would like to reserve the last couple of minutes for a final argument, but to point out the very last factor, and that is the ability of the other spouse to meet their own needs. Mr. Boring wasn't working. Mr. Boring had shown the court substantial evidence of job searching, of attempts. That's why the court said you're not voluntarily unemployed. This amount of money, Your Honor, sometimes you just have to look at the whole picture and ask yourself if it makes sense. It doesn't.
Thank you, counsel. You've got a minute 54.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Tamara Vincelette, 16352. I represent the appellant. May it please the court. I would like to pick up on the education of Mr.
Excuse me, under the appellee.
I'm sorry, the appellee. Thank you very much.
I was nervous we had two people complaining.
No, I believe that you should uphold what Judge Berryhill found. I think that there was record evidence for all of the findings that he made. With respect to Mr. Boring's education, when Mr. Boring was asked on the stand what his plan was for getting more education, he had, at that point, he had testified that he had had several stints of undergraduate education at the University of Wyoming, followed by stints at the University of Cheyenne, I believe, Community College, that he had gone to an accelerated program through Regis University, and that he had gotten this certification in project management through the University of Phoenix, the same university through which my client obtained her four-year undergraduate degree. So at the time that he was on the stand, he had no plan based on knowing how many credits he needed to finish even though he was asking for 4 or 5 years of maintenance, he hadn't put together how many credits he had earned or how much time it would take him to finish a degree. He didn't know what course of study he wanted to take up. He didn't know where he wanted to do it. So he absolutely had no plan. And Judge Berryhill noted in his findings that Mr. Boring had conceded he had no plan for pursuing a course of higher education, even though on his way out of the marriage, he claimed to want a 4-year degree. The case law states that it is the intentions that are expressed during a marriage as to the desire to get a 4-year degree. In Olar, the parties had an agreement during their marriage that husband would complete his undergraduate education, followed by wife having an opportunity to do the same. And when the divorce occurred before wife had been able to complete her undergraduate degree, the court said that was not fair, that the intention during the marriage was that she should have time to get her undergraduate degree, and she was allowed maintenance so that she could do that. So there's a distinction between the facts of our case and Olar. In looking at all of the the factors of 1410.114d, the factor that has been left out of the equation in Mr. Chaplot's arguments is the ability of the spouse from whom maintenance is sought to meet his or her needs while meeting those of the spouse seeking maintenance, which is F under 1410.119.4. And in this case, unlike in the case of Antuna, where there was $8,500 of excess earnings of Dr. Antuna to pay maintenance to the lesser earning spouse, in this case, what the court found was that after all of the expenses that needed to be paid by Donna Boring, she had $721 left per month of disposable income. He nevertheless found that after child support of $1,028 a month, she was in the hole $307 a month. So she had no funds with which to pay the maintenance that was sought by Mr. Boring. And in fact, under the holding in Crabtree, a case that's cited in the respondent's brief, the court says you cannot enter an order that will impoverish the paying spouse, which is what would happen for Ms. Boring. The court thereafter still entered an order of $1,000 a month for Ms. Boring to pay Mr. Boring maintenance, and therefore found that Ms. Boring was in the hole $1,300 a month and a little bit of change, and Mr. Boring was in the hole, I believe, $1,135 a month. So Ms. Boring was the one who was in the greater deficit position. Now, I believe that the court, there's some confusion about what the court in fact ordered with respect to Mr. Boring acquiring employment. The court found that people, not just women, not just men, gender neutral, people who are 48 years old, as Mr. Boring was about to turn when we were at trial on January 3rd of 2011, are working in this society. They're working at the age of 48, 58, and in many cases in this economy, 68. And he found that Mr. Boring needed to get a job. It didn't necessarily need to be the job that Mr. Boring ultimately wanted or liked, and it didn't need to be a job that paid him as much as he wanted to make, and he was given 2 years to get that job. But the judge found that on the basis of what Mr. Boring had been able to earn in the fall prior to going to permanent orders, $15 an hour, he was capable of contributing $2,600 a month to his own living expenses. And he therefore found that since Mr. Boring wanted $4,000 a month to live on, he could get it by $2,600 through his own efforts, $1,028 through the child support that he was ordered, plus $1,000 that he was ordered through maintenance. So the judge was very conscious of the amount that he was awarding Mr. Boring, given what Mr. Boring had asked for. The court was also conscious in that he had taken into account, it's true, Mr. Boring wasn't going to be paying a mortgage, but the court assumed for purposes a number higher than what Mr. Boring had said rent was going to cost him. He ballparked it at between $1,500 and $1,900 a month. The court said, I'll give you $2,000 because you're going to have utilities, and so I will ascribe $2,000 a month for your housing, and you're going to have $450 of new expense for the COBRA insurance that you're going to have to cover yourself. And so the court did focus on the needs that Mr. Boring was going to have when he decided what amount of maintenance he was going to award. It wasn't a willy-nilly number that wasn't based on some need of Mr. Boring's for living. Now, with respect to the standard of living, Mr. Chaplot suggests that if you have a high number of income, you therefore enjoy a nice standard of living. What that nice income does not fully explain is the party's serious reverses in the businesses that they had tried to make a go of during the marriage. And the evidence was that both of the parties had done due diligence, primarily Mr. Boring, who had brought the opportunity to open a franchise when he couldn't find a job. Ms. Boring said, think outside the box, get a franchise that you can do on your own. So Mr. Boring brought the Sportsworks franchise, and after about 6 months, he ceased doing anything required to actually work the franchise according to the plan, and that went down the tubes. Well, the party still owed debt for buying the franchise, and they still had costs at the time that Mr. Boring quit putting any effort into that effort. Ms. Boring had knew that she was going to lose her employment in calendar year 2007. And so she planned to open a women's fitness center. Unfortunately, the timing of that business too, which Mr. Boring worked in, was unfortunate. And by about May of the business did open in December of 2009, October or December of 2009, I'm sorry, eight. And by May of 2009, Ms. Boring was very well aware that this was not going to be her relief from working in a high-pressure corporate environment, which she had hoped to escape by going into business for herself. So there were huge, huge debts involved with closing down that business, including the leasehold that they had taken out and the loans for equipment. So the Borings had significant expenses, and Judge Berryhill went through Ms. Boring's sworn financial statement and noted that what was going to be expenses that would be going away at a period of time before finding what her actual committed expenses were every month. And the court found that, as I have said, that he took out attorney's fees and accounting expenses. He took out the amounts that had been put onto the children's worksheet, child support worksheet. He got down to just those numbers that were true expenses, and found that she had $721 left. Now, that does not fund a extravagant lifestyle. So these parties didn't have an extravagant lifestyle. And in fact, what the court found is they can't afford to be in the house, a $900,000 house that they had purchased. That house has got to be sold. So nobody, if people were living on ramen noodles, everybody was in the house together, that was the meal that everybody was sharing. I want also to go to the point that attorney's fees are likewise not a function of gender bias. There was a case that came down in September of 2010, Connerton v. Nevin, which states very clearly that the trial court, let me back up. Mr. Chaplot believes that he was not able to put in an attorney fee affidavit when he asked to, and that is the sole reason, as a function of Judge Berryhill's gender bias, that he was, that his client was not awarded attorney's fees. And there are two arguments to that. Number one is, during the course of the hearing, if Mr. Boring wanted his attorney's fees to be ordered, he needed to have provided evidence to the court upon which the court could make a determination of reasonable fees that Ms. Boring would need to pay Mr. Boring. During the course of the hearing, there was no evidence put on as to the number of hours Mr. Chaplot had billed his client, the rate Mr. Chaplot had charged, the necessity of the services that Mr. Chaplot had rendered to Mr. Boring, the reasonability of the fees in the community in which Mr. Chaplot works. None of that evidence had been provided, in addition to there not being an attorney fee affidavit. And it wasn't until the close of evidence, the resting of Mr. Boring's case, closing arguments, and the very last point of orders that Judge Berryhill was entering, that Mr. Chaplot at that point asked to submit an attorney's fee affidavit, at which point the court said, evidence is closed. The one case that I have been able to find, In Re the Marriage of Jackson, says that it is not a discretion, an abuse of the court's discretion not to reopen evidence when, after evidence is closed, one party wants to reopen evidence to submit evidence that they forgot to put in their case in chief. That is what happened here. The second point is the purpose of 1410.119, which is the only statute under which fees were requested, is to equalize the party's financial position. And in this case, where Ms. Boring had negative $1,300 a month and Mr. Boring had negative $1,100 a month, they were on an equal footing. Ms. Boring didn't have the advantage of a lot of the, of her income available to pay attorney's fees. And so the very reason for 1410.119 does not obtain in this case. The reason that Mr. Boring didn't get attorney's fees is much more likely because there was no money to pay them, the parties being left in roughly equal position by the court, as well as the fact that the court simply had no evidence upon which to base any findings about what were reasonable fees. And in the case of Nevin v. Connerton that was entered in September of 2010, the court did not order that the issue of attorney's fees would be heard after the hearing. That's the case in our case. The parties did not stipulate that mother could submit her attorney's fees by affidavit after the hearing. Same as in our case. Therefore, mother was required to present evidence of the reasonableness and necessity of her attorney's fees during the hearing. Same as in our case. And I would submit to you that not only in the Nevin case, Connerton case, but in the Stress case, in which a mother was also denied her fees because she didn't put in evidence.
Pardon me, till your time.
Thank you. Excuse me.
Good afternoon,
Your Honor. To Mr. Chaplot, you've got a minute 54.
Thank you. Your Honor, I'm going to just very quickly address the attorney's fee issue, kind of go backwards. And that is, you know, In Re the Marriage of Hill, as well as, Your Honor, another case cited by counsel in her case, In Re the Marriage of Mitchell, do not stand for the proposition as she proposes it. In Re the Marriage of Mitchell, in that case, the father objected to an award of attorney's fees. The only evidence, according to the case, was mother's testimony that this is how much I spent. and the court made an award of attorney's fees. In this case, there was a request for attorney's fees. In fact, the courts may check, it's in the joint trial management certificate that respondent was requesting attorney's fees. He testified to the $9,000 in attorney's fees. By the way, approximately the same amount of attorney's fees generated by mother in this case.
Did he testify that it were $9,000 attorney's fees, or did he testify that he got a loan from his family in a certain amount, and that was to help pay off attorney fees?
I believe his testimony was that he had filed $9,000 and had paid that toward attorney's fees, Your Honor. I believe it was $2,000 and $7,000. Your Honor, the court did admonish Mr. Boring in his order. He said, I got to tell you, Mr. Boring, this has got to be a short-term situation. As you said, you're going to be, tomorrow's your birthday, 48. Most people that are 48 or 58 or sometimes 68 are working, and they're working full-time. And sometimes, unless they've got a trust fund, they can rely on their inheritance or no children. Mr. Boring was 48 years old. He was out of work in his chosen field. He hadn't been for many, many years. He had attempted to run a business, and that business failed. And now he is back at square one, and he's 48 years old looking for a job. I've seen those 48 and 50-year-olds working at Walmart, Your Honor. This is not an assumption that is fair to Mr. Boring at the time. Mr. Boring had shown the court substantial evidence of his efforts. Your Honor, if I may finish with just five more seconds.
5 seconds.
A friend of mine once said, if it looks like a duck, it walks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. When you look at this case, with the experience this court has in this area of law and the other cases it's seen, it just doesn't hold up. It's an abuse of discretion.
Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.